I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and voters are heading to the polls in droves in the Massachusetts special election to fill Edward Kennedy's Senate seat. Democrat Martha Coakley and Republican Scott Brown are locked in a pitched battle that political pundits are calling a referendum on President Obama's plans for health care reform, which hangs in the balance. Election officials here from working-class New Bedford to suburban Framingham say it's been crazy today. A line of cars nearly a half a mile long stretched outside one polling place up in North Andover, north of Boston. The Massachusetts Secretary of State is expecting turnout comparable to a presidential election. Nearly half of all registered voters are expected to go to the polls. Last month, the turnout in the primary of this race was barely 20%. Here Now's Monica Brady Meyerhoff has been following the story. She's at the polls this morning, joining us from one in, I understand, Democratic-leaning Boston. Monica, where are you?
That's right. I'm at an elementary school in Boston, and it has five precincts in it, and they all say turnout has been very brisk, definitely better than the primary, and on par with a presidential election. Now, several of the poll workers also say they've seen elderly people driven here by volunteers. That's probably part of Mayor Tom Menino's strong urban political machine that's really legendary. But if you look at what turnout could mean in this race, conventional wisdom is that a high turnout is good for Democrats. But that's because Democrats outnumber Republicans 3-1 in the state. But also there's a large number of independents, and we just don't know how they are voting today.
Over 51% of the voters in Massachusetts are now registered independent. And you mentioned the Democratic Mayor Tom Menino, who has been a strong supporter of Attorney General Martha Coakley. So key is turnout for her in Boston. But this is a statewide election.
Mm-hmm. It is, but all over the state, we're hearing a lot of turnout in many different places. So that's going to throw a lot of the predictions out the window.
Well, we don't like to do a lot of deep reporting on the day of an election. We feel this is the day when people are, have made up their minds or are on their way to the polls. But we know you have one opinion from a voter on each side of the aisle. We know that ads from the Brown campaign have been all over the airwaves. Ads from the Democrats have been all over the airwaves. You spoke with a Brown supporter who spoke about the ads. Let's tell this, first of all, set this up. What's the opinion about the ads that he expresses?
Well, I heard from several voters who said they voted for Scott Brown that it was his negative campaigning that led them to the polls today to vote for him.
I voted for Brown. Why? Because I think he's the better person. I don't like the negative campaign that she was running. She was very negative about everything. And I don't feel that the seat belongs to the Democrats. I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent.
Monica, that was a Dan Muse from PBD, Massachusetts. But who is paying for a lot of these ads? Because we understand that after a bruising primary, Martha Coakley didn't have a lot of money.
That's right. These ads were coming from the Democratic National Committee, because when she came out of the primary and beat three competitors, I'm told she only had $300,000 in the bank, and she couldn't get competitive on the airwaves right away. Scott Brown was the first one to launch an ad. And then when it looked like the polls were tightening, the DNC jumped in. A lot of people gave her more money, but they also came out with really heavy attack ads on TV commercials and also in mailings that were pretty nasty at times.
Well, and on the other side of the aisle, you met many supporters of Martha Coakley today, and we're going to hear from one. Her name is Linda Grisham of Medford, and she spoke of why she is voting for Martha Coakley, and she remembers Ted Kennedy.
Martha Coakley, because I need somebody who's going to support the things I love, which is healthcare and work for women and schools.
She went on to say, Ted Kennedy, that this is his seat, and that is a sense among many Democrats here in this state. But there's also a pushback to that of many independents saying, why are we assuming this is a Democrat seat? Why do we assume that the voters will give it to the Democrats? Even the Kennedys themselves have come out and said they're trying to dispel the notion by saying Vicky Kennedy saying that her late husband believed it's the people's seat. It's not Kennedy's seat.
Well, the people are coming out today despite the snow. Monica Brady Meyerhoff will be covering it for us. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, let's take a turn here. We haven't heard much about the war on drugs lately, and that may be because it's not what it's called anymore. The Office of Drug Czar has also been downgraded from a cabinet position, and when President Obama's drug czar assumed his job, he's Gil Kerlikowske, he comes from law enforcement, he said the phrase war on drugs implied a war on people who are often victims. Well, he and his second-in-command, A. Thomas McClellan, know those people. Both men have sons who've struggled with addiction. Dr. McClellan lost a son to addiction. Dr. McClellan is the deputy director, the second in command at the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Before that, he researched addiction at the University of Pennsylvania for decades. We want to speak to him today about where we are on the approach to addiction in the U.S. But first, Dr. McClellan, it is impossible for us to start with anything other than our condolences for the loss of your son.
Thank you. Yep, it's not ever something anybody's happy with, but these kinds of losses are preventable, and I didn't.
So. Oh, you personally feel you didn't?
Yeah, I think any parent would feel that, and we have the tools now to do a lot more, and it's important that not just me, but everybody gets access to those kind of tools and knows how to use them the right way.
Well, your son was involved with alcohol and other things, and again, our sympathy. His brother, your other son, was in treatment, and we understand your wife has wrestled with issues. So, of course, the question is, how does that family experience shape your thinking on addiction? You've just given us a little bit of an idea.
Well, I think it's very much like people who have family experience with any other illness like diabetes or hypertension or cancer or any of them. It's interesting because the disease of addiction has about the same level of genetic contribution, same relapse rates. So it just makes it more important for people whose families are affected to redouble their efforts.
Of course, the thing that it has that some of those other illnesses you mentioned don't have is this huge stigma. And so we want to talk about how you get around that in changing policy. But first, what might the policy be? We understand your office is releasing its drug policy strategy next month. So give us an idea. What might we see?
Right. It will not move away from interdiction and law enforcement. What it will do is add something that has been absent: prevention, intervention, treatment, and recovery. Addiction and substance abuse are every bit the public health problem that they are the public safety problem.
Well, and we understand as a part of this shift, you've called for an integration of addiction treatment into primary health care. How would that work?
Well, it's addiction's an illness. And for so long, it's been treated in a segregated fashion, less than adequate, less than desirable addiction treatment. There hasn't been much of it, and much of it has been simply not as desirable or as effective as it could be. And just as importantly, it's prevented the rest of healthcare from paying appropriate attention to substance use and addiction. And substance use and addiction is a cause of significant costs, morbidity, and lack of quality in the rest of healthcare.
Well, so many people would agree with you that not being concerned about, let's say, alcoholism would be like not talking to a morbidly obese person about the dangers of diabetes.
But absolutely.
I know that you're calling for doctors to use the 314 yardstick to talk to patients about drinking.
That's right.
What is that?
It costs about $6 to do in a recent study from Washington State, and it could save as much as $500 per patient per year in unnecessary health care costs just by asking whether people are drinking more than 3 drinks in a day, 14 drinks in a week. And if the answer is yes, they should be counseled to reduce that level of alcohol.
Aren't doctors going to come across people who say, that's not a problem? Are doctors really going to be able to, get that person to counseling?
Drinking 3 drinks a day or more than 14 drinks in a week does not mean you're an alcoholic. But here's what it does mean. Mm. It means that if you're getting a prescription for an anti-anxiety agent, if you're getting a prescription for a beta blocker, those drinks are affecting the nature of the treatment for that condition. So it would be exactly the same as asking about any other drug that a person might be taking when a doctor makes a prescription.
I want to move on to some of the other addictions and how they may be addressed, but staying, with alcohol and just the idea of integrating addiction into someone's personal care. There are people who think that this isn't the job of the government. Heather McDonald of the Manhattan Institute told the New York Times, I'm not sure the federal government has an obligation to try to rehab addicts or, you know, ask questions like the ones you're asking. Government has an obligation to provide safe streets to people. Now, you've said that your plan is not to take away from the law enforcement aspect of drug enforcement. But, you know, there are people who don't think that's their job as taxpayers.
Well, these taxpayers are paying in lost productivity at the workplace. They're paying in excessive welfare dollars, and they're paying extraordinary amounts in incarceration costs because of unaddressed substance use.
What about the worry that this is that slippery slope to decriminalization of drugs? We know that the drug czar has said no, but Attorney General Eric Holder earlier this year announced that the Department of Justice would deprioritize cases against medical marijuana users as long as they comply with state laws. And if you couple that statement with the mean harm score test that just came out, and this is specialists got together and compiled a list to rank substances in terms of harmfulness. It's called the mean harm scores for 20 substances.
Right.
And alcohol ranked number 5, way above marijuana, which was number 11. So some people are worried that there's a slope here towards saying, drugs aren't that dangerous.
Well, you're not going to hear that from this office. The drugs that have the greatest harm are the drugs that have the greatest availability. Alcohol and tobacco, very clear. Now, we don't think there's a good argument that marijuana is good for the public. Why would you want to introduce a new intoxicant into an environment, particularly today, where we have two wars going on? We have record unemployment levels. We've got all kinds of problems. How does adding another intoxicant into the mix increase the benefit to the country?
Well, you know, some supporters would say that it might cut down at least on the war across the border in Mexico. If it was legalized, it wouldn't be this violent, illegal industry.
Well, let me give you a better example. Let's take a drug that's already got, I think a lot of people would call, significant controls, but has had record availability. I'm referring to prescription opiates. Prescription opiates have gone up more than 1,000% over the last 10 years.
This is OxyContin and others.
Yeah. That availability, even with controls, has led to record numbers of overdose deaths. Prescription opiates are the second leading cause of accidental death in this country, second only to automobile accidents. 16 states, it's the leading cause of accidental death. So we're not in favor of adding new problems to the society.
That's Dr. A. Thomas McClellan, second in command at the Office of National Drug Control Policy, one step below the drug czar. We've been talking about their plans to add more treatment and prevention to U.S. policy. When we come back, what would that look and feel like? We'll hear more about that. Also, later in the program, private searches by private rescue firms in Haiti. How do you look for specific people when so many others are in need of help as well? We'll talk to them. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Dr. Thomas McClellan, the second in command at the Office of National Drug Control Policy. He's been explaining the Obama administration plans to add more treatment to law enforcement to make addiction more of a medical issue, not just rehab and 12-step programs. Dr. McClellan has studied addiction at the University of Pennsylvania, and he lost a son to an alcohol and drug overdose. But many opposed to expanded treatment say it doesn't work. They point to an 80 or 90% failure rate. So, doctor, I know you in part agree. You say that's because we're not doing the right treatment. So we hear about meds and vaccines. Tell us, what does work?
I'm glad you asked that question. There's a lot of things that work. Addiction is best thought of as a chronic illness. It's got the same relapse rates as other chronic illnesses. It's got the same genetic background as other chronic illnesses, but we've been treating it like it's an acute care episode, like a broken leg. You get 30 days of treatment or 12 sessions of treatment. Then there is a graduation ceremony. Everybody's hugging and crying, and you're sent off Imagine if you treated hypertension that way, 30 days of care followed by a graduation and a lot of good luck. When you treat addiction over the long term, not residential, you get remarkable benefit.
Well, how do you do that, doctor? Because there are a lot of people who have to hold down jobs. And again, it's a stigma thing. Do you see addiction becoming like smoking, where sort of like everybody talks about it and, you know, you may feel a little badly if you, you know, you are the one smoker, but at least it's not the kind of thing that you want to keep a secret from your employer or your insurance company?
Right. I hope to God the rest of the addictions have the same fate as we have brought to bear on the addiction of smoking. Not seeking help for your smoking problem is now stigmatized because there are so many very useful, effective options. That's what we want for the rest of the addictions.
Well, and then how do we pay for it?
Well, first, we're paying in excessive emergency room visits. We're paying in excessive hospital days. Our administration is suggesting early interventions and sustained outpatient treatment. It's cheap. It's effective. The first thing is to equip individuals and families and communities to recognize early signs of addiction and people who are vulnerable to addiction. If you, for example, are a male and you have a first-degree male relative who has an alcohol problem, you are 3 to 5 times more likely to develop an alcohol use disorder. Next, let's have early interventions right where you go for your primary care checkups. If substance use has turned into an addiction, you ought to have available treatment, and it ought to be long-lasting, and it ought to be a combination of medications, counseling, and behavioral change strategies. It's not more money. It's less money.
Give me an example of behavioral change strategy.
Be aware of the triggers that will quite reliably produce craving and even withdrawal symptoms. They can be physical cues, like a $20 bill, produce craving in cocaine users, okay?
Is that true?
It's absolutely true, yeah. It will produce craving even in someone who is laying on their back in an MRI machine with a deafening sound of the magnets in the background. You show them cues for cocaine, and they may not have used cocaine for 6 months, and their brain lights up with exactly the same constellation of response as if they had just shot up cocaine.
When you show them the $20 bill that they presumably used to roll to inhale it.
Right.
Huh. But what do you think of the vaccines and some of these things that were supposed to be miracles, but we don't feel that we're hearing that?
Oh, you haven't seen the vaccines yet. They're just coming out, and I think they will be miracles. There are new reports that have just been released for a cocaine vaccine. There, you're seeing protection against cocaine re-addiction for 90 days, one injection. We haven't been treating addiction like an illness, so we haven't been investing the kind of time, energy, thought, or money into medically oriented treatments. When we do, we're going to see the same kinds of effects.
That's Dr. A. Thomas McClellan, Deputy Director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. We began by talking about your own loss. I only want to mention it again in the context of the fact that both you and your boss, the drug czar Gil Kerlikowske, have had this in the family, have wrestled, struggled with this in the family. I can hear some people saying, well, that means you're the last people who should handle this issue because, you know, you're going to be soft on them, or you're going to feel there's something you can do to save them. There's nothing that could be done. This is what jails are for. You know, how would you respond to that?
My view on that is that after 35 years of studying and working in the field of addiction, plus being surrounded by it in many of my family members, I am one, but just one, of the people who knows just how devastating this illness can be. So I hope that my personal experience enforces what I've learned in science. I think we have the kinds of policies and practices we're going to suggest that will be both sensible and understandable to people that are affected, but really have sound scientific underpinnings.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, and you're talking about treating addiction as more of a disease than a choice.
Yeah.
Does that remove a burden from the family, the fact that it's a disease? Or does it add, you know, some sort of a different burden to the family? Because right now it's as if a family, and we heard you say it, it's as if families feel there's something that they could have or should have done, which would be like someone saying, gosh, why didn't I cure my mother's cancer?
Well, I'll tell you another illness that's in my family, cancer, particularly skin cancer. Now, one thing you might do if you have a young kid in my family, you might say, hey, look, stay out of the sun, okay? And you might call that prevention. And it's not that long ago when cancer, too, was stigmatized and it was thought to be hopeless. Well, addiction's not hopeless. And like cancer, there are treatments available and there are important things that families can do and should do. That includes my family, too.
Dr. A. Thomas McClellan, again, Deputy Director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sure.
Okay, taking a look ahead. Tomorrow on Here and Now, remember that imam who went from Virginia to Yemen and called for attacks on America? Is he even alive? We'll take a closer look tomorrow. The latest news is next, Here and Now. Officials now put the toll in Haiti at 200,000 dead, countless injured, and 1.5 million people homeless. A week after the magnitude 7.0 quake struck, the flow of food, water, and supplies from the city's lone airport is increasing, but tens of thousands of people sleep in the streets or under plastic sheets in makeshift camps. The port remains blocked, and relief workers say they fear visiting some parts of the city because of increasing violence. Just 4 blocks from the presidential palace, where U.S. troops landed today to cheers of some Haitians, hundreds of looters were rampaging through downtown despite warnings from police. Yesterday, Haitians stormed the gates of the capital's airport, searching for food and water, and had to be beaten back by American troops and UN police. Meanwhile, thousands of Haitians queued outside the U.S. embassy, desperate to leave, while thousands more continued to walk out of the capital, leaving the city, which can no longer support them. The BBC's Matthew Price reports on the latest situation in and around Port-au-Prince.
Through the smoke of 1,000 campfires, another day of despair is just beginning. The children gather for breakfast, but there is little here to eat. Among the homemade shelters, a city struggles. These are the homeless, the helpless. They have nothing except their dignity. From their tiny radios comes news of the aid effort. But here, there's nothing to show for it. And the anger, which might yet tear this place apart, is growing.
We don't have no houses. Most of the houses destroyed. Even the houses stand up, people scared to sleep on them. Most of these people don't eat since Tuesday night.
Haiti's humanitarian crisis is worsening by the day. With more than 1 million people living out in the open, the risk of disease and of death is growing. They have no money, no jobs, no way of rebuilding their houses. And without a sustained commitment from the international community, this country, already one of the world's poorest, will be set back a generation. When buses arrive, there is chaos, a scramble to leave. Those who can are fleeing this city, worried that disease and violence could erupt. But this is not yet a place turning in on itself. They are organizing themselves, putting up signs at the new homeless camps. And the government's construction teams are out, clearing the debris.
We have so many things to do that we cannot afford to sleep. We have so many lives we've been trying to save.
Have you saved any lives?
Yes, a lot.
Haiti's agony is clear to see. But some help has arrived at the hospitals.
Don't really have much drugs that I can give them for pain. I'm just doing the best that I can. We have piles of people outside who require to get in here still. So we're trying to get people out the door as quickly as possible.
Still, it is a world away from the desperate scenes we saw here a day after the earthquake. When there were no doctors, no medicine, just the dying and the dead. Today, at least, there is hope. But not for everyone, not for 9-year-old Stephanie.
Her father, Carlos, tells me she will die, that the hospital doesn't have the right equipment to carry out an operation to save her life. So they wait as she slowly slips away from them. Remarkably, some are still being pulled out alive. A 6-year-old boy and a 14-year-old girl this time. But these flickers of joy are few and far between. How many more can be alive after all this time? Night comes at the end of a day of despair. They bed down, anxious but surviving, for now.
That's the BBC's Matthew Price in Port-au-Prince. Very hard to hear. To see an audio slideshow of how one community in the U.S. is hoping to help Haiti, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Back in 30 seconds. Here and Now. Well, as we just heard, hundreds of thousands of people are suffering in Haiti, and there are countless heartbreaking stories, including that of 19-year-old Brittany Gengel of the Boston area. She, three fellow classmates, and two faculty members from Lynn University in Boca Raton, Florida, are missing. They just arrived in Haiti to do humanitarian work when the earthquake hit. A private security firm hired by the school initially said they'd found the students, but that turned out to be wrong. Their families are now desperate. Here's Brittany Gengel's father, Len, calling on President Obama to help.
President Obama, you inspired our generation to give back, to commit to help others, the poorest of the poor. They have done that. And father to father, I am asking you, we are pleading to you, to go get our children.
Well, that plea underscores the Solomon-like question, who gets rescued? And what role should private security firms play? Dan Richards is CEO of Global Rescue. They're based here in Boston. His company has been hired to help find employees of large insurance companies and nonprofits who are trapped in Haiti. His firm was not the one working with Lynn University, but he gives us insight. And Dan, you also say you have sympathy for that firm because the situation is so chaotic. So, but in that chaos, how do you make sure your employees aren't getting in the way?
Let me give you an example. We have a former Army Special Forces officer who is on site with a team at the Montana Hotel.
And this is the hotel that collapsed, and these students are from Lynn University are thought to be in that rubble.
Correct, with several hundred other Westerners, many of whom are Americans. And so our four-man team is there. It turns out that one of our personnel had actually served in Peru, and there's a Peruvian Army unit there that's working on this building. We have offered our services to help them in any way that we can to remove some of the debris and get through some of the concrete and the rebar that is preventing rescuers from getting down to these folks.
I understand you have a former Navy SEAL and a member of the U.S. Army Special Forces leading the group that arrived in Haiti on Thursday. How'd you get there so fast? I mean, describe the mission.
We get asked that question frequently, and the people who are asking the question oftentimes maybe expect a sort of a Hollywood answer, but most of it's pretty mundane. We took commercial airline flights down to Santo Domingo.
In the Dominican Republic.
In the Dominican Republic, and we actually have some personnel there as a staging area. And then what we did was we took private air from Santo Domingo into Port-au-Prince, and that private air was both fixed-wing aircraft and rotary-wing helicopter aircraft to get our personnel into the country. And the way that we made it happen was we applied for landing slots just like any other organization. In the first 36 hours after the tragedy, there was a high degree of chaos before the U.S. military moved in and started controlling the airspace. And so we were allocated a number of slots. And because our personnel were actually already on the ground in Santo Domingo, we were able to get on the airplanes, get our gear loaded onto those aircraft, and get into the country. Our hope is that they get the port back online so that large amounts of aid can come through ships and that the military secures the road in between Santo Domingo and Port-au-Prince, because that is an absolutely vital artery, and our personnel are aware of attacks that have occurred on truck drivers on that road, and it's vital that it gets secured.
Well, staying with security, you also, in addition to rescue, you also provide security in a lot of dangerous areas.
We do.
Any questions of interfering with what's going on in certain areas? And in this case, your people are armed.
Well, we don't comment usually on active operations. With regard to the equipment that our personnel carry or their means of defending themselves. All I can say about the armament and security issue and possible interference is we take our obligations very, very seriously, and we certainly understand what the possible consequences could be to going into some of these areas, both for our personnel, because they're putting their lives at risk and in harm's way to accomplish the mission, and also for innocent bystanders and our clients.
And I know there's some privacy issues with some of your clients. Tell us about a client you can talk about in Haiti.
We successfully evacuated a group called Village of Hope, and they are a humanitarian organization that was actually down in Haiti prior to the earthquake, providing humanitarian assistance to the people of Haiti. The location where they were housed, many of the walls had collapsed. They were running low on food and water and were out of fuel. And they had contacted us in the hopes that they might be able to be evacuated.
But then there's the question we started with, and it is a Solomon-like question, you know, who gets rescued? You know, when you or your people are there and you realize it's people who have the wherewithal, who can hire you to come in. And some would say, well, shouldn't it be the Haitians that get rescued first and not, you know, people who work for an insurance company based in Boston, you know, who has the money to fly people in and out? There's still Haitians under buildings.
Robin, this is the scope of this tragedy is it's unbelievable. And when you enter a zone like the one that exists in Port-au-Prince and other parts of Haiti, it's hard not to be affected and try and provide assistance to whoever you encounter who needs it. And our rescue teams, as they've been working through the country, have been doing just that. Now, that said, we are being funded by private entities who have retained us to do a job. And we're going to do it absolutely to the best of our ability and try and find and take care of the folks who we've been tasked to rescue. That doesn't mean that we can't try and help those along the way. And in fact, we were able to actually free up space on some of the aircraft that we were using for humanitarian and aid organizations. So we had extra seats and extra cargo capability. And so we filled those with actually a group of doctors was on one of our aircraft. We had other humanitarian personnel who were involved in demining and ordnance removal because of some of the weapons issues that are occurring down in Haiti. And so what we do is we try and, to the extent that we can, allocate resources to some of these other organizations if they need it.
But then there are concerns about a slippery slope into what seems to be a world of, you know, contract armies and paid vigilantes and security for hire. And you're a part of that.
So some of these companies, without question, have lost their way. And, you know, I think for any of us, whether we're in the news media or in government or in other parts of the private sector, there's a moral compass, I think, that has to be part of what the entity's core values are. And for us, we really are a rescue organization. That is our core mission. All I can tell you is we take these obligations very seriously and certainly not lightly.
That's Dan Richards. He's CEO of Global Rescue. They've just sent how many people to Haiti?
At the peak, we had about 25 people on the ground.
To help in rescue missions there. They're paid by corporations and nonprofits to do that. Dan, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
And by the way, we'd always love to hear your thoughts. You can always go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send us an email, or just scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage. hereandnow.org. And before we go today, a remembrance of Robert Parker. You're listening to Here and Now. The upcoming Grammy Awards could be big for Boston-based guitarist and composer Julian Lage. Though he's played on two Grammy-nominated recordings in the past, this year he's up for an award of his own. His debut CD, Sounding Point, is nominated for Best Contemporary Jazz Album. This song is called All Purpose Beginning. It could have been titled just Beginning. Julian is just 22. Even so, he's been playing the guitar for over 16 years. He graduated from the Berklee College of Music and fronts his own ensemble on Sounding Point and in stage shows where he looks like the happiest young man in the world, which we pointed out when we visited him last May. And Julian Lage joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You do have this sort of permanent, and I mean this in a good way, goofy smile.
Well, how about that?
Have people told you that?
People have expressed that they, you know, it's very clear that we enjoy what we're doing. And it kind of emanates throughout the whole group, I think.
But you do have the biggest smile. I just want to listen a little more to that song, All Purpose Beginning.
Yeah.
What's the sound that we're hearing around your guitar playing?
Oh, that's pencil writing on paper, actually. It's based on the idea of someone writing a letter, actually, a letter I was writing to a friend. And I thought it had a very evocative sound. It could be a love letter, could be an angry letter, could be anything you want.
It's what our show sounds like a lot, because I doodle.
Yeah, it's a very humanistic kind of touch.
There you go. There you go. Well, we heard that you picked up the guitar at 5. You grew up in the Bay Area of
California.
Right.
That's right.
What propelled you?
Well, there was a guitar in the house. My dad played. And at the core of it, I just wanted to do what my dad was doing. I asked for a guitar when I was 4, and my parents said when I was 5, if I was still adamant about it, they'd gladly get me one. And I think I just loved the way it felt, the way it looked, the way it, just the way it was and the way it sounded. And that's kind of what drew me to it.
You were a prodigy of some sorts when you were young. I'll say it because it's hard for you to say. And in fact, there was a film made about you.
Jewels at 8.
Jewels at 8.
Yeah.
What was that about?
Well, it was a thesis project by a director named Mark Becker. I just happened to be the subject, but it really wasn't about, it wasn't intended to promote me or my music or anything. It was kind of a day in the life of a 7, 8-year-old student, I guess, you know.
Prodigy, yep. Uh-huh.
Well, and it wasn't as much that, you know, in retrospect, when I see it, it wasn't about how gifted I could be perceived as. It was more, here's me going to school and dealing with friends and this and that, and then here's me going to a rehearsal with a group of adults. And I think what you take away from it, or at least what I do, is that there's still a person there. You know, and the Prodigy label was always very, you know, people were trying to be nice, but it was I never felt it was very fitting for me. And I think the movie captures that.
He's currently dividing his time between second grade and the Conservatory of Music at San Francisco. Ladies and gentlemen, Julian Lage.
Is there any part of you that wishes that you had those childhood years back? And gee, I could have picked up the guitar at, you know, 15 and probably still been as good.
I can't think that way.
No, no.
I think that's maybe more an outside perspective on it, but I wouldn't trade anything, no.
And you played blues and classical, and why that? Was that, again, your dad's music?
Or? Well, blues was more or less my dad's music. He listened, both my parents, both my mom and my dad. Then the classical side was around, and some of the jazz was too, and I think I just kind of picked up whatever I could.
But you ultimately, you know, switched to jazz, but when you went to Berkeley just recently, you studied classical music.
Yeah, I was pretty focused on classical composition. I've been kind of the student throughout my life where I would just find, you know, every book about composition I could, every book about orchestration, and just study it and kind of nerd out about it.
So did you picture yourself, you know, and maybe you do still, as, you know, the next Osvaldo Golahov or John Adams or a modern classical composer?
Well, I'd love to be in a field where I could collaborate with them and take on projects that are kind of in that realm of larger works. Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, in the meantime, let's hear a little more of what's on your CD, Sounding Point. This is one of your solo improvisations, Familiar Posture. Now, we hear this was inspired by Alfred Hitchcock.
That's right. We did 10 recordings of solo guitar, and the theme was Hitchcock preludes, and I guess what that meant to me, at least, was that we're trying to achieve some kind of suspense by using themes from the rest of the record.
Foreshadowing there. a la Hitchcock.
That's right.
Who are your guitarists? Who are you emulating when it comes to the guitar?
I think there are characteristics about certain people, especially Jim Hall. I was always a huge Jim Hall fan. People like Charlie Christian or Django Reinhardt. I mean, that's in the jazz world. I think Julian Bream is probably my favorite guitar player. So, yeah, I think I'm drawn to characteristics about everybody.
Well, and the everybodies are, you know, starting to pick up on you.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing with them. And let's listen to one of three pieces on the CD where you're joined by banjoist Bella Fleck and mandolin player Chris Thiele, both Grammy winners, you know, big-time musicians. Let's listen to The Informant.
The way those guys work is incredible. I mean, they're so musically gifted and they're such hard workers. I think I drew a lot of inspiration from that for the rest of the record, because we recorded that first and then went back a month later with my band.
Yeah.
And the rest.
Well, I want to refer back to where we began, which is this big, goofy smile that you have on your face now. I thought it was just, and it's wonderful, and I thought it was, you know, maybe one of those raptures that we hear musicians get, you know, when you're playing. It's sort of, you know, you look like Stevie Wonder, you know, so happy when you're playing. But now I'm seeing that it's maybe not the playing, it's what?
I think there's a positive energy that's kind of around a lot of the things I involve myself with, and it's hard not to be influenced in some positive way by it.
That's composer and guitarist Julian Lage. His Grammy-nominated CD is Sounding Point. Well, we wanted to take a moment to note a sudden and unexpected passing. Robert Parker has died. He authored 50 novels, including the Spencer series, which was made into a TV show. But Robert and his wife Joan were also philanthropic fixtures here in Boston. They raised two children. We once spoke to their son, choreographer David Parker.
It was a lively household in many, many ways. We were encouraged to give opinions, and if they were muddy, we had to make them clearer.
And family was equally important to Robert Parker.
Everything I do is a family affair, I think. Joan's the producer, Dave's the choreographer, and I'm not sure what I'm doing here.
Well, we were sure. Novelist Robert Parker died suddenly yesterday of natural causes at his home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was 77. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.